WOSU Public Media podcasts are made possible thanks to listener support. All of our digital content, such as Snully Goster and the All Sides of the Ann Fisher podcast, depend on the generosity of listeners like you. You can give at WOSU.org or through the WOSU mobile app. And thanks.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A 2020 Stanford University study determined that the negative effects of gentrification are felt disproportionately by minorities who have fewer options than their white counterparts when it comes to relocation. And there's plenty of data as the story has played out in cities across America, including in Columbus's King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood. Mark Ferenchik has covered Columbus neighborhoods for more than 20 years for the Dispatch. He wrote about the changes in the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood earlier this year for Columbus Monthly Magazine, in particularly how changes will affect the neighborhood's history and longtime residents. Mark Ferenchik, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ann, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Good.
You cover urban issues and the Columbus neighborhoods. I call on you often to talk about all the myriad issues afoot in our neighborhoods. What's happening in the East Side neighborhood of King Lincoln Bronzeville that made it a focus of your article?
Well, there's been a lot of change there, certainly in the past decade, with a lot of renovation and new construction. The Adelphi Quarter apartments just opened back in the past few months. There are other new apartment projects going on. Homes are selling for $400,000, where a decade and a half ago they were selling for $55,000. And in the meantime, there have been a number of new white residents moving in, while south of Mount Vernon especially, the number of black residents have dropped according to latest census figures. So there certainly is a lot of what you would call gentrification going on there right now.
You know, what do we know? I want to talk about what the city's done to improve the neighborhood. But I also want to know about what the city's done, if anything, to stem this, because this is just getting to be an old story. We've heard it over and over and over again.
Yeah. So can you hear me, by the way?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Our connection, I think, had a little problem for a second there. So the city's put in a number of improvements there in terms of road and utility improvements, things like that. If you remember, a number of years ago, there was a dispute. There are a number of people who wanted to keep a good part of the Poindexter Village public housing complex there because of its historic nature. It was built back in 1940, and people wanted to preserve that, and also because it meant a lot to the black community who had roots there. And in the long run, that did not happen. They kept two buildings, but they redeveloped that area into senior housing and also a lot of market rate apartments over there as well. So a lot of this is just market forces, basically, too. Again, this area had been, a lot of people would say, neglected for many years in terms of city help or city focus. Mayor Coleman back in the early 2000s decided that there would be some more effort put into revitalizing the neighborhood. So the Lincoln Theater was renovated with a lot of city money, a lot of public money. And since then, there have been other projects. But a lot of this is just simply, again, market forces at work. Now, again, recently, I wrote a story back in September about an apartment building back in over on 21st Street that was recently purchased. And the residents who've been there for a long time, especially older residents, were worried that they would not be able to afford the new rents. They were going to raise the rents from $500 a month, $600 a month to $950 a month. And people cannot afford that. The property owners said that Section 8 would help pay for that, public assistance. But the people I talked to said, we are not on public, you know, public vouchers right now, housing vouchers. So there's a lot of worry that some longtime residents there will be forced out.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about gentrification, and we're focused today on the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood, which is what my guest, Mark Ferencek of the Columbus Dispatch, wrote about for Columbus Monthly last spring, I think. If you have a question or comment coming up, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you live in the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood? Are you from the neighborhood and you want to tell us about what it's like and why you left? Maybe give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah. So when the city is improving the Lincoln Theater, for example, Mark Ferencek, what's the end game? What are they shooting for?
Well, they want to help bring the neighborhood back to some extent, certainly. But one of the problems is that what can the city do to keep current residents there? And that's going to be the struggle. Part of it is what they can do is, again, they have formed a land trust. So when people will build houses on those parcels of property, the goal is so they don't raise so much in value, so it's hard to for people to afford them, basically. So that's part of it. But it's going to be tricky, I think, in King Lincoln because there's a lot of demand over there, and because when there's just a lot of demand to buy housing and to build new housing, property values are going to go up. And it's not just King Lincoln. It's also what's already happened in Victorian Village and Italian Village, certainly what's starting to happen in the Milo Grogan area right now, where you have houses going for $300,000 or $400,000. Which is a lot, especially for a neighborhood that's not seen that recently, and how to keep people in neighborhoods where if your property values are going to go up because of all this redevelopment, your taxes are going to go up, and that simply is going to be difficult.
So when you're talking about the land trust, can't they set aside property in that and just artificially depress the value, or is the city not allowed to do that?
Well, I don't know what they can do when it comes to that. I think, you know, what the thing is too, when you talk to people in neighborhoods as well, is that some longtime residents who have been there a long time want some of this new development. Maybe they don't want to see their neighborhood change overall, but because they've lived there, say 20, 30, 40 years where property values have not increased, where there's been actually a lot of, housing demolition, and property values have remained depressed. Now they're all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, the past few years, there's become an interest in a lot of these central city neighborhoods. And so longtime property owners, including Black property owners, are looking forward to, again, some of these areas rebounding in value. And again, it's just tricky when you have other people who simply cannot afford what the property taxes may do, and also what some of the rents are doing in some of these neighborhoods too. And there definitely are people who are going to be forced out because they can't, in some cases, afford to pay the rents. And some of these new properties in King Lincoln, there are new apartment complexes that are being developed by Shiloh Baptist Church, for example, and the WOTA group. They're supposed to be affordable housing, but in other cases, these rents are high, you know, well over four figures. And what does that mean in terms of, again, preserving the population that's already there?
You know, this is not just any old neighborhood. This is an important historic neighborhood in Columbus. Tell us a little bit about what we're talking about here.
So the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood was the center of Columbus's Black community for many years, specifically before 1960, when I-71 basically cut the neighborhood off from downtown Columbus. A number of Black professionals lived there, whether they be doctors, lawyers, business people. Long Street had a long retail history of
lots of stores, shops catering to the community, and also hotels. Well-known performers like Count Basie and Duke Ellington played in the neighborhood and also visited the neighborhood. So it has a long history with the Black community, and a number of people want to make sure that that is preserved.
And why putting the expressway in? I guess it was 70 is what?
71.
71. Of course. 71. What the impact was extreme on the neighborhood, right?
Right. So a number of homes obviously were demolished to make that happen, but also in a lot of ways it cut off the neighborhood from downtown. Even though there are bridges, Broad Street Bridge, Long Street Bridge, other bridges that connect the neighborhoods, there was a disconnect. And also then there started to be some disinvestment in the neighborhood. Mount Vernon Plaza was built. There was, old style urban renewal projects back in the 60s and 70s. But the neighborhood in a lot of ways languished for a number of years. Now it is actually rebounding in population. The neighborhood south of Mount Vernon Avenue actually grew by almost 19% in population between 2010 and 2020. But again, a lot of that population growth was due to white population moving in. So, again, because there are lots of very attractive houses in the King Lincoln District, well-built, a number of years ago, and people are paying a lot of money to be in those homes now.
Is there any kind of not in my backyard element going on? So when they're talking about developing and, building so-called affordable housing, are there people who are opposed to that? They say, yeah, of course we want to diversify the neighborhood, but not in my backyard.
I have not heard or seen too much of that so far. Again, there still is a wide variety of homes mm-hmm. in the King Lincoln area. Again, it's a fairly large neighborhood geographically. It goes north to I-670, east to Nelson, south to Broad, west to 71. So there still is a lot of diverse housing stock there. There had been a lot of vacant lots there too. Again, where the Adelphi Quarter is being built, that was the location of a former funeral home that burned. Lots of vacant property along Long Street, and that has been filled up. And that's what's happening in other cases too, where people have been building on vacant lots as well.
Where the city has worked to preserve the neighborhood, say with the, the Lincoln Theater, how's it doing? I mean, are those enterprises flourishing? What's the story there?
So there are new retailers there. There's the Waffle Place that's just across the bridge on Long Street. And there are some other retailers that have established themselves in the area, too. It's almost like downtown in a lot of ways, though. It's going to be based on more population growth. I think there will be more retail there once, the population continues to grow and there's a larger market. So that is happening. But it's again, it seems to be following whatever the residential trend would be.
The city did invest a lot of money in beautifying the bridges, or at least particularly the one bridge over. How is that? Yeah. I mean, has that been sustained?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Has it been sustained? They've kept it up.
Yes, absolutely right. That again, there's a murals on the Long Street Bridge, basically documenting the history of the area, and that has been sustained for sure.
Well, Mark Ferencik, thanks for kicking this off for us. I really appreciate your time today.
Okay, thanks, Ann. Appreciate it.
You bet. Mark Ferencik, Columbus Neighborhoods and Urban Issues reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll have a link to his article in Columbus Monthly talking about the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood and the changes afoot there. Stay with us. We have more to come. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. To some, gentrification is a result of civic pride, the restoration of a once vibrant community that has fallen on hard times. To others, gentrification means displacement of longtime residents and the erasure of a neighborhood's history. Michael Wilkos is the Senior Vice President of Community Impact for the United Way of Central Ohio. He also has degrees in urban geography, Black studies, architecture, and lives in a Columbus neighborhood experiencing demographic shifts. Michael Wilkos, welcome back to All Sides.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Anne.
What do we know about how important demographics is when it comes to the nature of a neighborhood?
Well, we just went through a pretty dramatic period here in Columbus. The 2020 census just came out with some new data. And just to set some backstory to this conversation, the city of Columbus just added 119,000 people in the last 10 years. It was the largest numeric increase in population growth we've ever experienced in Columbus. The growth rate that we experienced was the fastest since the 1950s. And so we have incredible amount of growth. 90% of all of the growth in the state of Ohio occurred in Columbus City and our suburbs. And we have been chronically underbuilding housing. And it appears to many of us that there is a lot of construction happening in our city. I often hear people say, who's going to live in all these new apartments? And the reality is we have been chronically underbuilding for the last 10 years. That has really caught up to us, particularly in this COVID era, as we've seen housing costs in every city across the country escalate. And that is really playing out in a handful of urban neighborhoods, which are really kind of facing the brunt, if you will, of chronic underbuilding, a surge of population growth, and now we have demographic shifts. There are many housing consumers that are different types of households, single households, households without children, people who want to live together that aren't married, and they're looking for different types of housing products. And those products often happen to be in some urban neighborhoods near downtown, and we're seeing that play out. And so if you look at one of the most striking things I saw in the data was in this zone that starts on the edge of Grandview Heights through what's called Fifth by Northwest or the Fifth Avenue corridor, down through Harrison West, Wineland Park, Italian Village, downtown, King Lincoln. That zone of the city added 44% population growth in 10 years or added 14,000 additional people. I think that trend's going to continue. And so we're seeing this in every city across the country, even in places like Detroit, Cleveland, and Youngstown, where the populations continue to fall. They are, in fact, rising relatively rapidly in the downtowns and adjacent neighborhoods. And that really looks like, and it's also a different race, ethnicity, and demographic shift.
Right. That was my next question, is what does that 14,000 people look like?
It looks different, for some of those areas, right, like Fifth by Northwest and Grandview Heights and, you know, some of the neighborhoods just near north of downtown, those have always been predominantly white. In places like King Lincoln or, you know, even in Wineland Park, the demographics are very different. And what I mean by that is we're seeing the largest, so the white population in the city of Columbus and Franklin County actually fell in this last decade, despite significant population growth. So 100% of the city of Columbus and Franklin County's population growth are people of color. There are a few neighborhoods in the urban core that are experiencing a significant racial shift. The Near East Side is probably the center of that racial shift. And I pulled some data because I know you wanted to kind of talk about that in particular. On the Near East Side of Columbus, which north of Broad, between Broad and 670, has historically been a very strong series of neighborhoods, or predominantly the Black community. South of Broad, between Broad and Livingston, has had a more variation in its racial makeup. But the Near East Side in total saw the white population in the last decade jump from 19% to 37%. As the Black population fell from 75 to 58. And there is no other part of our city that is seeing that kind of racial change. Conversely, we're seeing huge increases in the Black African-American population in the suburbs, and particularly in the suburban areas of Northeast Columbus, there were three census tracts that are all connected to one another in far northeast Columbus on the edge of New Albany. So think the 161 bypass and Hamilton Road. You know, the percentage of the Black population there jumped 270, 240, and 194%. And so what we're witnessing are middle class and upper income families of color that are moving to those neighborhoods that are safer, better schools, more opportunities. And you're seeing white consumers who often don't have school-age children moving back into the center city because they're taking advantage of convenience, lifestyle, and maybe proximity to their jobs. And this, by the way, is happening in every city across the country. It just so happens that this past decade, we saw some of the most dramatic shifts of demographics we've ever experienced.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the demographic shifts here in the year after the decennial census. And my guest is Michael Wilkos. He's Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Central Ohio, where he manages United Way's investment in approximately 80 nonprofit partners. And all of these kinds of issues matter to the United Way and a lot of other people. We've been focusing on the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood as an example of these major shifts in population. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In particular, we're thinking about the issue of gentrification and how it tends to disproportionately affect people of color. They get pushed out. But Michael Wilkos is making a salient point that also a lot of middle class African-American, Black people of color families are choosing to go elsewhere, whereas the lifestyle of the urban dweller is more apparently is of, more interesting to an increasing number of white, probably childless or people with young children, to kind of chart a new path. Let's see, Leslie, you're in Columbus and you're a landlord, right?
Yes.
Hi, Leslie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I grew up in the Bronzeville area and community, and right now I no longer live in the community, but I am a property owner. My husband and I have a rental property, a double on 22nd Street, and we want to maintain it so that people, working class people, can afford to live there. But it is very difficult. We have an onslaught of people trying to buy our property, and we, as African Americans, we want to maintain our presence in our community, and we would like help from the city. It doesn't seem to be forthcoming. We also want to maintain this property because by the time my grandchildren are ready to purchase a house, they aren't going to be able to afford a house. I don't know what's going to happen to young people, because the price of housing is just astronomical. It's frightening.
When you say that the city can't help you, Leslie, what kind of things are you asking for?
Well, it appears to me, and maybe, I'm old, so I'm not necessarily savvy about a lot of things, but it seems to me that certain investors are able to obtain all kinds of loans and assistance from the city that my husband and I have never been able to acquire. We've never been able to obtain money to make improvements on our property. So we make improvements slowly but surely, and we're trying to maintain the integrity of the property. So, when you're trying to repair box gutters, you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. But that's what we're trying to do. We don't want to just tear down and replace everything. We want to keep the character of our property.
Go ahead.
One of the things that really is bothersome to me, the alley behind our property is just filthy. It is beyond my comprehension. The city never cleans it up. I don't know. It's those are the things that are very troubling. And I would think that in some communities, we have these giant garbage cans. I mean, these industrial garbage cans. I think that if they would just put in regular garbage cans like everybody else, there wouldn't be such an overflow of garbage and just junk that's tossed back in that alley. And I have complained to the city, and I've asked for regular-sized garbage cans, but we don't have them. But other communities on some of the other streets that have been developed, like 22nd Street, none of those streets have these industrial garbage cans.
Leslie, thanks a lot for that call. You know, Michael Wilkos, I think Leslie makes a really interesting point that their developers, they want to provide housing and affordable housing for people, but they don't, because they're small, they don't get the same kind of benefits, probably like tax abatements and all kinds of other things that big developers get. Is there an avenue for the likes of Leslie out there? Is there a path?
So Leslie actually brought up lots of great points there. Yeah. I'll just kind of unpack a few of those, right? On one hand, she's talking about the huge increase in housing price. And I'll give a little bit of facts to put that in perspective. In the last 24 months, the median price of a home sold in the Columbus Metro jumped $61,500. The increase in rents, by the way, from a two-bedroom apartment had jumped from $831 to, I think, $1,023. The underpinning of that huge increase in housing cost is that chronic underbuilding. And a lot of neighborhoods, both urban neighborhoods and suburban neighborhoods in the city of Columbus and suburban communities, are kind of fighting density. They're fighting development proposals. And, you know, hopefully we'll have a little bit of time to talk about that. But at the same time, Leslie's talking about wanting to maintain an old property, and old properties are expensive to maintain. 100-year-old houses have costs. And things like box gutters that she brought up is just one of many examples. And so, you know, Leslie's in a very difficult spot where she wants to maintain the property, but then doesn't want to pass those costs on to the renter. And even if Leslie was able to secure some housing subsidies and services to maintain that, that's one going to be difficult because it's rental housing that she generates income off of. And she does, from what I understood from that brief conversation, was the occupants don't have a rental subsidy. And it's very hard to let some for the city say, and I'm not an expert on the city services, but it's hard for the city to provide a subsidy to an individual landowner who lives somewhere else, who's maintaining a property where the occupant doesn't actually come through a subsidized housing program. Okay. So she's in kind of this quandary. Even if there were tools for someone like Leslie, that's not going to generate the tens of thousands of units we are currently short of, because there are 54,000 renter households in this community that are paying more than half of their income. And so where is the city or any entity going to look at investing significant dollars? It's going to be in places where they can generate a 100-unit building and a 200-unit building to start to eat away at some of those. There are tools happening across the country. And it's important for us to also acknowledge the housing dilemma that we are currently in is not the housing dilemma we were in even 8 years ago. I was making presentations in 2012 about the proliferation of vacant and abandoned housing and how that was pulling neighborhoods down. In Leslie's neighborhood that she grew up in, the vacant and abandoned house, or the vacant housing stock on the Near East Side, fell 34% in the last 10 years. There's 1,206 less vacant housing units on the Near East Side than there were 10 years ago. Why are there so many less units? Because we have a housing shortage, and neighborhoods like Northland and Linden and the Near East Side are being caught up in this larger narrative of a rapidly growing city, chronic underbuilding. Leslie's trying to maintain an old unit, but not wanting to pass those maintenance costs on to her tenant. And that's a lovely thing. And I admire her for wanting to do it. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Right. Leslie, thanks so much for your call and best wishes. Boy, that is a challenge. You know, I was reading a New York Times article, Michael, about a guy who'd been living four generations of his family, African-American gentleman, four generations of his family had lived in the same brownstone. And his kids just aren't interested. And he's probably going to make a bucket, you know, a boatload of money off of it. But he's sad because he can't pass it on to another African-American family unless someone can pony up the money for it. It just doesn't make any sense. It's his savings.
Yeah, and so, you know, the other thing is, because this challenge is so new for us, it's hard to write policy for a situation in a city where, you know, 8 years ago it was, you know, 180 degrees different. It's shifted very, very quickly. And believe it or not, rents in Columbus, housing costs in Columbus are so way below the national average. They're just accelerating at a rate the likes of which we've never seen. And if the rate of this acceleration continues, our housing problem will be the same housing crisis that the Seattles and Denvers and Austin, Texas are now facing. I mean, you just saw in the last week, Tesla is moving from the Bay Area to Austin because Austin is so much cheaper and Austin is running 100% more expensive than Columbus. So, you know, as I look, because one of the other things, Anne, that you were curious about, and I always love that, you know, you want to make Columbus better and you're curious about the city, you know, when you look across the country, there are community land trusts and rent control and just cause eviction ordinances and community benefit agreements and tenant options to purchase and vacancy taxes. We now have a community land trust, right? That's new for us. It is in its infancy and it is just starting. But as Columbus is beginning to struggle with these issues, I think you'll see some of these other tools begin to be deployed here. We also have a regional housing strategy that the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission just completed last year, which talks about more than 100 strategies. What do we do in urban neighborhoods? What do we do in the suburbs? What should we be doing in Madison and Delaware and looking in Fairfield counties? We also have the city looking at redoing the entire zoning code for the city, which was last comprehensively redone 70 years ago. And then there's the Affordable Housing Alliance, which is doing advocacy. But I also want to point out that probably one of the biggest experts, the National Low Income Housing Coalition, really tried to put the gentrification and displacement narrative in perspective. And what they say is, you know, there can be benefits to gentrification, but only to long-term residents, usually homeowners in those neighborhoods, who are not pushed out. You know, development without displacement is really the key that I think we should be focused on in Columbus. But we should be fighting against displacement rather than fighting against development, because if we don't have development, the housing cost inflation that you're seeing is only going to increase, because every 12 months, there's 24,000 more people in this community. And if we don't start getting more production, we will see housing costs go up for everybody.
And when we're talking about something like the King, just before I have to let you go, Michael, when we're talking about something like King Lincoln, Bronzeville, what do we want? I mean, it's not going to go back to the way it was before they built 71. We want a mix, and we want a fair mix, right?
We do. And what we want is to have neighborhoods across our city that provide people the opportunity to live at different stages of their life without having to move out of the neighborhood, which means we want apartments and accessory dwelling units, meaning apartments above garages. And we want small single family homes and larger single family homes, because the typical American moves many times throughout their lifestyle because they're trying to find a housing product that matches where they are in that continuum of life. And so if we can build a different variety of housing stock that matches the demographics, we could have neighborhoods that are more self-sufficient. The reality is, we have not been building the diversity of housing that matches the diversity of our demographics for some time in this country, because outdated zoning codes, for the most part, are still producing lots of single family homes, and they're not producing micro units and small apartments and all those other things. In that MORPC regional housing strategy, it lays out a plan for our region to do just that.
And then just one more thing before I let you go. I'm sorry, but the point that the caller made about what a dump it is in the alley behind the house that they own there, the duplex they own. I mean, I do drive around Columbus, and I am just startled sometimes by the how junky things look. And you can go from one neighborhood to the next. How does a city make those decisions? I mean,
So let's not blame the city too much. Okay. I live in a neighborhood that has those very issues. I've got a lot of people who put Lazy Boy chairs and mattresses and dumpsters that they shouldn't do. They should put it in the alley and call 311.
Okay.
You know, you've got a one driver in a vehicle with a mechanical arm, and if the dumpster's full, you know, things blow out. So there's some responsibility. There can be improvements, but there also can be some responsibility. But Leslie really hit the nail on the head. We talk about, you know, why aren't more people, you know, choosing some of those neighborhoods? Well, there's some people that don't want to deal with that. And the reality is, in King Lincoln, there still is not a grocery store. You don't have a lot of neighborhood services. The schools academically struggle, and you've got trash in the alley. So if you are a family of color that can't afford a $500,000 or $700,000 house, and you have school-age children, places like Gahanna and Westerville and Pickerington and Reynoldsburg and New Albany are very attractive.
Michael Wilkos, as always, thank you so much for your insights and your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Michael Wilkos, Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Central Ohio, where he manages United Way's investment in about 80 nonprofit partners. We are going to continue our conversation with a program co-chair of the Maroon Arts Group and a resident of the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the 1960s, journalist and author Jane Jacobs's book, The Life and Death of Great American Cities, argued that urban renewal and slum clearance disrespected the needs of city dwellers. Jacobs helped lead efforts to protect neighborhoods from urban renewal, an issue that continues to resonate across the country. As old neighborhoods are rehabilitated, the demographics often change and disproportionately affect people of color and their history in that neighborhood. Excuse me, we're focused on the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood today. Taisha Radford Shorts is program co-chair of the Maroon Arts Group and a resident of the King Lincoln Bronzeville neighborhood. Welcome to the show, Taisha.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You have expressed concerns about the history of the neighborhood not being told accurately in the first place, not being represented in the first place, however it might end up looking. Why?
Yeah, I think, you know, once we stop sharing those stories, or when we're sharing those stories inadequately, then the history of a place gets lost, right? And then it becomes easier to kind of experience some of the things that we're experiencing, the displacement of residents, the, you know, tearing down or destruction of, you know, historic properties, et cetera. So I think it's really important to make sure that, one, we're telling those stories, and two, that we're telling them as accurately as possible.
WOSU Public Media did a series of documentaries on neighborhoods, including King Lincoln District. I think it was before we started returning to use the word Bronzeville to go with it. But in any event, it depicted an incredibly vibrant, it's just hard to imagine how vibrant that community was at the time. What do you know about it?
Oh, man. So similar, right? That it was a vibrant community, that it was also a community of I hate this term, but I think it applies, of mixed income, mm-hmm. right? So we're thinking of a community of entrepreneurs who are wealthy, or who are at the very least very kind of stable in their period of life. And there were people who experienced poverty. There were people who experienced income inequality. There were people who were day laborers, right? It was a community of human people. And I think some of that gets lost when we start to, you know, romanticize the area a bit. So I do have memories of those kind of communally. I have people in my community who were here for the Coming Home Festival, right, on Mount Vernon Avenue. my parents were married at Calhoun Memorial Temple Church, which is currently on Long Street. It was recently sold, right? But that was the family church. So that's where we would have Easter Sunday. There was a member who would serve dinners right after church. So just memories of and knowledge of people living their lives with dignity and humanity. And unfortunately, who for reasons that all of your callers have kind of talked about today have been displaced and have taken parts of that history along with them.
Before you moved there 15 years ago, what brought you back?
My husband, who also tells me to tell you hello, he's been on your show, Marshall Shorts, but we actually moved back to the neighborhood so that we could, one, we took over a property that another community member and business owner had. She was moving to a different space. She wanted to make sure that, you know, younger family who was kind of up and coming as far as their economic condition was concerned, was able to have affordable housing. And so we were able to move into her property. And then we ultimately moved into the home that we live in now, both of which were in the are in the Bronzeville neighborhood. But we live here, we work here, we play here, right? So this is a neighborhood for us where we are actually, it takes a lot for us to go outside of the community because we're always looking, who do we know in the area who can do X, right? Landscaping, who can do concrete work, who can, you know, all of the things that we actually need as homeowners. We're trying to see how we can have it fulfilled in the neighborhood first before we go outside of it. And fortunately, we're still successful in that regard. It takes a lot more legwork, but it is still possible.
That's really neat. But there are some things that are still missing, like a grocery store, right?
Absolutely. Grocery store, affordable just produce and wares. That are in walking distance, right? So we can look at a certain mile radius of how to drive, but not everyone has that level of transportation. The bus line doesn't go to all available grocery stores, right? So when we're saying that in the area, we're looking at grocery stores and markets that are in walking distance and easily accessible to all residents. You're absolutely correct. You know, and that's unfortunate because I think there have been some opportunities for that to have been developed. And I don't know, perhaps that's not, I'm not sure what the level of revitalization is, if it's, you know, sewage and then it's property and then we ultimately look at grocery stores, but that we haven't reached that level yet, I guess.
Well, I think
there
it has a lot to do
Carl
with
Brown, IGA, sorry.
It's a lot to do with density, just getting enough people in the neighborhood living there. And then, you know, a grocery store requires, I guess, I'm just speculating, a certain density. But what, you know, it's not going to go back to the way it was back when it was because of redlining and segregation and discrimination and racism. All of those things came to bear and create this beautiful neighborhood, ironically, right? But it's not going to go back to that. What do you want it to look like? What are you looking, what kind of balancing act are you thinking about here?
Definitely one of parity, right? Where the folks who live here can choose if they are leaving. That's first and foremost, right? We don't want, I'm going to say I, because I want to speak on my own behalf, but I don't want residents to be pushed out. I want, if they choose to leave, that to be their choice and something that they're able to kind of do deliberately and thoughtfully. And then definitely something where residents are able to have autonomy over the decisions that are made. And it really feels like a lot of the transition that's happening has been decided by some entities that we either don't see or that are under kind of the umbrella of an institution, and that current residents aren't necessarily those at the table making those decisions and offering valuable input until something is already in motion. So those are the two primary things that I would want to see. Certainly can't return to where it was. And Bronzeville was developed in part because of, you know, Southern horror and great migration, right? So we don't want to go back to that at all. But we definitely want a neighborhood where folks who live here have the primary, have autonomy over their ability to stay or leave.
And you're saying that you don't feel like you have a seat at that table when the decisions are being made. What does that look like? I mean, how do you find out about things and what people are doing and talking about in terms of changing?
Sure. So I don't have a seat at the table personally. And I feel like several residents don't either. I think a great example of that was, tearing down of Poindexter Village, and that by the time most of the residents in the area were aware that it was happening and there were community meetings that were held, just as a standard point of operation, the decision to tear down the properties had already been made. And so then it became an issue of what can we salvage, because we already know that this process is in motion. There are folks in the neighborhood who could have offered opportunities for parts of the housing, if they weren't all occupied, to become arts residencies, right? To become transitional housing, right? So people who live here and have very real lived experiences are the experts on what they need. And I think that particular instance was a decision that was made based on how the city at large wanted to see this area, as opposed to how current residents actually envision the area themselves.
You know, I'm trying to think. I remember I was a columnist at the time, and I was there when they were tearing it down, watching it and observing that. And they also decided they did set aside some of the units for a history, a museum. Yeah. But I'm wondering if that happened now. So that would be like, easily 15 years ago, I think, is when that happened, wasn't it? Maybe a little less.
Just a little less than that, but just about.
Yeah, right. I'm just wondering if it happened today, how would you do things differently?
Again, there. So the folks who physically, if it happened today, one, we would want to imagine that there are actual people living there residing there, living their daily lives. Would it be a conversation with residents, with management? Would it be a conversation that would pull in churches? Would it be a conversation that pulls in area commissions? Would it be a conversation that includes school administrators and school personnel, right? Like I'm just thinking of how this type of decision is made in the first place, of deciding to tear down residential properties. But then also I'm thinking of folks who were not at the table, whether, by choice or they weren't invited, who could offer alternatives and see, can we raise money for this particular alternative? If the city wants this to happen, how can the city contribute financially toward an end that a group of folks have determined? I think an interesting fact about the Bronzeville neighborhood, Mayor Scarborough was elected, right, by the people who lived in the neighborhood. And he wasn't a mayor of the city proper, but he was someone who was designated by the residents to represent their interests. Perhaps there's something that's done in that way. We have NEAC, which is relatively new, and not relatively new, it's about 40 years old, but it's still developing, and folks who are here are getting more engaged. But how would a representative from NEAC be designated or deputized to represent the interests of the residents here when it comes to development, when it comes to changing over property from residential to commercial, et cetera? So I think we haven't been as imaginative about it as we potentially could be. And a part of that has to do with removing residents whose lived experiences could inform those changes out of the neighborhood.
I think it's interesting when you brought up one of the potential options, and we're just about out of time, Taisha, but is
that bring me back?
I will. Is a, Hardison residents kind of options, because so many of the neighborhoods that have, return from the ashes, so to speak, have been because of artists and things like the Maroon Arts Group. It somehow it becomes a stabilizing force in a neighborhood, right?
It can be stabilizing and it can be destabilizing as well. I think, that's a different conversation that's a longer conversation for a different day, of how cities sometimes use arts to attract folks and still continue in this process. Some elements of Maroon Arts Group's shipping containers are used for a property on Monroe that's being sold for $350,000 when 5 years ago it would have sold for $55,000, right? So the arts can be manipulated and used toward a negative end, but it can also be this very positive, very beautiful way for the folks in the neighborhood and in the area to express themselves, to call to action, to galvanize, right, to politicize. So it has both positive and negative aspects. Maroon Arts Group, fortunately, is working toward those positive aspects.
It's been great talking with you, Taisha Radford Shorts. Say hi to Marshall for me. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We've been talking about gentrification. There are some options. Obviously, it's not the first time we've talked about it. It won't be the last time. And we certainly will invite Taisha Radford Shorts back when we do that. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.